what I wanted to do. And actually, when I saw your film, I was like, because I wanted two videos to kind of show the two different sides. So it would be great if you would allow us to use yours for that, and then do a similar video, but is relating to people with who are suicidal due to akathisia or prescribed drugs.
Well, I'm honored that you would want to use that video as...
I'd love to use that video. I think it's fantastic.
Well, thank you. And thank you for pointing out the other side of that as well, because it is like phenomenologically different. It's a whole different experience, I would imagine. I haven't had it myself, but I know what you mean. And I would love to hear you elaborate on it too. So I see why you say you want to bring it up in the interview. So I'll make sure we do address this officially and continue to communicate about like me sending you the link or the video or whatever you need. Well, yeah, beautiful. And again, thank you. Thank you for appreciating the video.
Yeah, it's really powerful.
That means a lot to me. Yeah, and it brought me into a significant reflection. I've never been suicidal, but I've had two uncles who committed suicide. And so I've been really exploring like what feelings do I still access around that? And a big one was just confusion, sheer confusion, which is related to when it happened, when I was much younger, a child basically for one and then in college for another. But anyway, a lot of confusion and sadness, of course.
I think it's just, and even though there are some common themes, I think it is so unique to everyone. And it's just that one, it's impossible because it's too late. It's always too late, isn't it, to really, and that's why research is so difficult as well, because we can't ask after they've gone.
That's a good point, huh? You can only research the people who haven't quite done it. And there's something different about the people who haven't quite done it, you know?
Very different. Yeah. Absolutely very different. Mm. But it's so interesting. And this area of you know, prescribed drug-induced suicide is one that I think experts are really underestimating. And they really don't want to acknowledge it.
Thank you to the listeners and watchers who have tuned into the Psychology Is podcast. Maybe this is your first time listening to it. Maybe this is your 49th time listening to it. I think that's the episode we're on. And either way, I appreciate your presence and I appreciate your presence, Beverly Thompson. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me to be here.
It's interesting. I've done a lot of the Zoom internet interviews and I've had to make the decision whether to give you the sensation, Beverly, that I'm making eye contact with you by looking into the camera or looking at your eyes, actually, and not giving you the sensation of eye contact. So I've gone both ways in this podcast, and I might alternate, but for the most part, I want to look at you. And so it won't look like I'm looking at you, but I am looking at you. And to the people who are only listening to audio, that's irrelevant. But for those of you watching the video, you see what I mean. We've covered so many different topics on this podcast, and it's been so fun for me. Everything from social psychology principles to what makes babies laugh to what makes a serial killer, the psychology of why we're so interested in serial killers. Such a like therapeutic techniques, all kinds of different topics. But one of our themes has certainly been mental disorders, so-called, and treatments, and the major problems with common practices in psychiatry. We've brought on guests such as Robert Whitaker and Peter Gutsche and Joanna Moncrief, who have been longstanding, solid critics of psychiatry. And this, I feel, fits within that kind of theme that we've covered. So you wrote a book called Antidepressed, and you've done extensive research into the evidence for and against the safety and efficacy of antidepressants. You have a great big picture point of view. You have a deep understanding of the incentives in the business of antidepressants. And I want to explore all of that with you. And even though you probably get asked this in most interviews you do, I would love to hear what led you to start investigating this topic.
Okay. I was a counselor in schools, primary schools and secondary schools. And about 12, 13 years ago, I started to notice that the language around children was starting to change. And I started to notice that we were more or less blaming children for having to deal with many difficult social factors that a lot of them were coping with. So I noticed we were starting to introduce terms such as, or questions such as, I think he's got ADHD, or I think there's something wrong with him, or I think there's something wrong with her. And that kind of sparked something. And then not long after that, I had a friend who, I think she was 18, maybe younger, I think she was maybe 17, started to take paroxetine, which is Suroxat in the UK, Paxil in the States, and ended up dying by suicide. A girl who was a very clever, very well-rounded individual. So there were a number of factors that led me to be intrigued by what was happening in society. I remember a few years later, somebody said to me, when you realize something's wrong, you have a responsibility to tell others. And I realized very quickly after starting this work that many things are very wrong when it comes to these drugs. And it became an obsession. I openly admit it became an obsession because I started to realize that the patient experiences painted a very different picture to the ones that the medical profession and the pharmaceutical industry portrayed. And I started to read, I think I've read thousands and thousands and thousands and listened to thousands of patient experiences. And I started to realize that these voices of these sometimes horrific experiences in life really needed to be heard. So I think that was the main motivation for my book. I kind of realized that there was a need for a book about antidepressants, but it needed to be written in an accessible style. So it needed to be written not in medical language or in academic language. And it needed to be a book that would empower people to feel as if they knew more and could make better choices about antidepressants. So I kind of thought to myself, I want to see patients thinking of themselves as consumers of these drugs with autonomy rather than patients with very little say over what happens to them.
Yes. Well, I think you succeeded in making the book empowering and accessible. And I think this is one of the many important criticisms against the way things are done in the field of psychiatry is most patients are not as informed as they need to be. And the responsibility is not on the patients, even though perhaps you could make the argument that we are all responsible to inform ourselves. But I think that it's incumbent upon the prescriber, of course, to inform the patient to the extent that they need to be informed, which is a significant extent. You need to be highly educated, I think, on just everything from the mechanisms by which these drugs have their effect in the brain, to the desirable and undesirable effects, to the long-term outcomes, to just the downstream effect, essentially, of that primary mechanism, whether it be like serotonin reuptake inhibition or whatever it may be, whatever the mechanism, it's usually that. Anyway, the downstream effect and all of the unknown, actually, the fact that the prescribers themselves often do not know what the downstream effect of this drug is going to be in this person's system. So anyway, just to say, like, the importance of being informed, can't, you know, we can't overstate that.
No, and as you say, the importance of being informed, and that's the professional being informed just as much as the patient being informed.
Yes.
And that is one of the huge stent problems that we have, is that the professionals know very little still, and in fact don't educate them the way that they should to when it comes to these powerful psychoactive drugs that they're giving to people.
Whenever I have these conversations, I always like literally try to imagine the presence of a highly intelligent, kind, well-intentioned psychiatrist who I would get along with well, sitting next to me, listening to everything, to kind of check, am I being fair? And so I always try to kind of maintain that gauge. And, you know, so far I do feel like I'm being fair. And I would have to look a person like this in the eyes and say, how do you justify this? If the person is doing that thing that so many do, which is prescribing drugs within one session of meeting with somebody and re-upping that prescription for long periods of time, how do you justify that? Are you just unaware of the evidence against that practice, or are you able to just somehow dismiss it? How do you justify it is my big question, because it's sometimes I think I need to like be careful and make sure I'm rational about this, but then sometimes I'm like, no, I need to be passionate and indignant because children are being prescribed psychoactive substances that are dangerously similar to methamphetamine, and they're being told that they need to be on this for the rest of their life. We need to be emotional about this too. So anyway, let's also be rational. And let me ask you a few more questions to kind of give listeners a more, you know, the systematic understanding of the big picture here.
Okay.
So my first question is, I guess, can you paint the picture for us? Can you paint the picture? Generally speaking, the state of affairs related to antidepressants in the world.
And I have to say, and I hope you kind of got this when you read the book, I tried to not be political and I tried not to pharma bash. That's, you know, those are two things that I seriously try not to do. But I have to say, it is incredibly difficult not to. If you are going to inform people about the facts. So I guess I suppose I could start by saying that really there's never been any evidence of what we call an epidemic of depression that we all talk about. But what we do have is, I call it a mental health pseudo-epidemic in the Western world. And antidepressant prescribing is cultural as well as medical, isn't it, in the Western world? So the constant mental health messages that we hear nowadays seem to be, I hate to say it, but I don't know how bad it is in the States, but over here in the UK, it's a media and a political obsession. You know, messages seem to lead to increasing antidepressant prescribing because we're told to get help, we're told to get screened. And ultimately, for most people, what it ends up as being is a prescription from a doctor or a psychiatrist. So governments and industry have kind of taken advantage of the fact that the public, us as consumers, believe and accept that antidepressants are safe and they're the answer to all the problems in the world, well, our particular problems.
I'll just really quick, please don't lose your train of thought, but I'll just add, in the States, we have the additional element of seeing commercials.
Yes, antidepressants.
There probably doesn't even have to be quite as much in the way of advertising for like screening and getting help, because you can just straight up advertise the drug to the person and say, ask your doctor about this if it sounds good and if all this footage has, you know, elicited a draw to it. So anyway, there's that additional element in the States too, which is just...
I know, I often think when I visit the States, if my son was with me and he was younger, I would spend most of my time covering his eyes and his ears. I know, it's difficult. It really is difficult. And I do cover that in the book a little bit.
Yes.
But, yeah. You know, we're told by psychiatry in the pharmaceutical industry, especially on TV and, you know, supported by governments and mental health organizations and charities and everyone else that, you know, we need to have good mental health and it's essential and we deserve it. And it has become an obsession. But I guess the question is, what's it really doing? And from my perspective, what I think it's doing is it's kind of enabling and allowing governments to fail to acknowledge and address the social determinants that are actually making our lives bad and causing us unhappiness and causing us to be depressed and anxious, and all the other symptoms that we associate with bad mental health. So they're actually telling us it's our fault, but if we think about it, it's not our fault, is it? It's their fault. But fortunately, they have a pill and they can tell us to take one and everything will be okay. So we're told mental health deserves priority with our physical health, but I think messages are kind of being strategically used by those in power to avoid responsibility. That's quite a big statement, I suppose, but you know, we live with poverty, we live with homelessness and unemployment, loneliness, and we're told it's our mental health and we need to fix it.
It's your chemical imbalance.
It's a chemical imbalance. It's your brain. It's not the fact that you're unemployed, Nick. It's not the fact that you're lonely. It's not the fact that, you know, you have no money to pay your electricity bills. It's your brain. It's your chemical imbalance. And we bought into it.
The absurdity.
Well, if we think about it as simply as that, I mean, how gullible have we been?
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, that's perfect. This is the ground. These are the grounds out of which, like, all of the psychiatric drugs can just thrive. You know, these are the conditions that are in place. I think that's what you just laid out for us that make it possible for the widespread embrace and prescriptions of psychiatric drugs. So,
and you know, paradoxically, this unnecessary treatment is just leading and has left millions suffering serious, often fatal adverse effects and left them with long-term medical conditions for which there are no solutions. So what started out with is supposedly helping us. Really?
Yeah, it's so ironic in a sense. And so you specifically focus on antidepressants, even though there are books that have been written and to be still written about each of the categories of psychiatric drugs. And so I want you to kind of explain to us why, you know, what the desirable effects are and what the adverse effects are in the short term and in the long term. But I want to just say something that I find myself saying on many of these podcasts related to this topic, which is, let's remember that we are talking about drugs. That we're not talking about medicine, we're not talking about a cure of anything, we're talking about psychoactive substances that exert their effect by crossing the blood-brain barrier and affecting neurotransmitter activity in the same exact way that all illegal drugs work. So let's keep that in mind here and just have that the appropriate framing around this, you know, what we're talking about. So now that we're talking about this class of drugs that we call antidepressants, can you explain to us what are the desirable effects and what are the adverse effects?
Okay, I'll start with a very, very long list of adverse effects. I think a patient information leaflet lists just under 200 what they call side effects, which I think it's a very small percentage of people who actually read a patient information leaflet, but you know, it's quite frightening that there are 200 adverse effects and then we still take them without even wanting to know what they are. So we choose to take antidepressants basically because the benefits have been widely promoted and the risks downplayed. And that has been since Prozac arrived in 1988. So there are some common experiences with in terms of adverse effects. But the one thing that we have to say is that nobody really knows how an antidepressant will affect you. And it's a pretty unique it's a unique experience for everyone. The problem is that doctors very, very rarely warn anyone about the adverse effects or the long-term effects of antidepressants. So some of the more serious effects I've got from here are varied and unpredictable physical and mental states, feeling emotionally numb, feeling detached, distorted dreams, agitation, headaches, suicidality, major problems with the central nervous system, complex neurological effects, chronic brain impairment, sexual problems, dependence, weight gain. The list goes on. Mm-hmm. And I have to mention the two A words of antidepressant adverse effects, which are akathisia and anosognosia. Yeah. So a study in I quote a study in my book, which was John Reed's 2018 study, I think, which has a good list of the most common adverse effects, but there's been very, very little research done. And what we do know is actually from patient experience and mostly in online forums rather than research. Mm-hmm. If doctors actually warned us about the possible adverse effects that we could have, then one, we probably wouldn't take them, and two, if we did choose to take them, we would take them for the shortest time possible.
Right.
We probably should, in terms of the most serious adverse effect, I would say that is akathisia, which...
Perfect. That's actually exactly where I wanted to go. So will you define akathisia? What is that?
So, as I said, I call it the A word of antidepressants. It's a medication-induced state, which can happen when patients start, stop, change dose, switch generics of some prescription medications. And also we know that some patients, I think it's between 5 and 10% of patients can't actually metabolize antidepressants, so they can become akathisic when they start taking the medication. So how do I describe it? So some people call akathisia the epitome of losing their mind because it basically causes an inner turmoil. It causes an uncontrollable physical restlessness, agitation, and paranoia. There's a lot of information on it in my book from the Akathisia Alliance for Education and Research, which is a very good organization in the US, and they're really trying hard to educate people. So I wanted to talk about, I listened to your very moving Dear John, Please Don't Kill Yourself film, and it's incredibly moving. And you talk about the situation where someone has the opportunity to choose life, and you talk about things changing and people being there to help. And this is where akathisia and prescription drug suicide presents a very different scenario to what we believe to be the situation most people find themselves in if they're contemplating suicide. So I believe that nowadays there are two sides to suicide. There's the very real one you talk about, and then there's akathisia or prescription drug-induced suicide. So from my research, I get quite emotional when I talk about this because I've read so many heartbreaking stories. So from my research, people with akathisia do not really contemplate suicide the same way as we might expect people do. In fact, most of them want and fight to stay alive. And they do everything they can to stay alive. And suicide becomes the only option when they become unable to cope with the intolerable physical and psychological effects of akathisia. Or in a lot of cases, their mind becomes so unbalanced and detached from reality, and they have these constant intrusive thoughts of suicide, and these thoughts are telling them to kill themselves. And it gets to the point where many people literally have no option but to give in to and act on these relentless intrusive thoughts. And because the suicide is drug-induced, it's difficult to find a way out and find people who understand or accept the situation is actually drug-induced. And for many, there's no help available because medics refuse to acknowledge or really don't understand the situation. So going back to your dear John, you know, these people also have a story worthy of being heard, but unfortunately no one wants to hear it and no one wants to listen, because ultimately it's a story caused by iatrogenic harm and medication that they've taken as prescribed. So akathisia can also be confused with psychosis, and so many episodes of first psychosis are probably akathisia or drug induced. So it's a really complex one, and we really need more research, and it's a fascinating one. And I really want to speak about it more in the future.
Thank you for speaking about it now, and the epitome of losing your mind. And then you described it in perfect detail. Just it's hard to even imagine what that would be like to have these intrusive thoughts that you finally just surrender to and feel you have no control over. That's devastating.
Yeah. And I mean, people say that they literally cannot control them. They have lost. We talk, you know, often about people losing their mind, but people describe it as literally losing their mind and having no control over their thoughts.
Do you have a sense of what percentage of people who take antidepressants will experience this to a significant degree?
No, we need more research. But what we do know is it happens a lot more than we know and is reported. And I think the thing that needs to happen is the first question when that needs to be asked when somebody does die by suicide is, what medication were they taking?
Right.
It needs to be a question that we ask.
You're right.
Because so many times we find out that they've either started to reduce medication, they've stopped taking medication, they have switched a drug, they have switched a generic, but it doesn't get reported.
Right. There should be a systematic, there should be a database that's collecting all that information.
Well, we have in the UK, and you should look at it. We have a site called Anti-Death Aware, and it's got about 5,500 cases of prescribed drug-induced suicide, and most of them were very young people.
And so you're saying that these are 5,500 cases of people who had committed suicide, and in the autopsy report, it came to light that they had been taking an antidepressant?
Yeah.
Wow. In the UK alone.
It's a very powerful site. And it was actually started by a guy whose young son died by suicide after starting an SSRI antidepressant.
it's almost, you know, I think some, my sense, like, it's interesting because I teach college classes. So one of the benefits is that you see like many large groups of people. And over time, you've really kind of gotten to know like thousands of people and in a fairly deep way and kind of get a sense of how they think. And so my sense is that many people have heard that there's this connection between antidepressants and suicide, but it's kind of unbelievable. It sounds too ironic that the thing that's supposed to stop you from committing suicide would actually cause you to commit suicide. But I just want to really highlight that there's evidence of this, and
we have to remember that, you know, that SSRI antidepressants have an FDA black box warning. They have a black box warning for under 25s regarding safety and efficacy. And the use of antidepressants by people under the age of 25 is associated with double the risk of suicidal thoughts and behavior.
I've heard the counter argument that the only reason that you see high levels of suicide in people taking antidepressants is because they are the people who were most extremely depressed and the drug just didn't cause it. It just couldn't quite save them. What would be your counter to that?
Yeah, I'm asked so often this question. It's a difficult one, isn't it?
It is.
But I think that if we actually look at the hidden trials, there's a very good book by David Healy that looks at all the hidden antidepressant trials. We will see that that's probably not the case.
Mm. And I think the cases of akathisia are also evidence that the antidepressants are actually causing it, because you see someone who's well on their way, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we need more awareness. We really do. And it's frightening. It's frightening that we're doing this to our children and young people.
The other devastating thing about this is the difficulty in withdrawing. And I pointed this out before too on this podcast, and I feel like it's worth repeating that when we think of someone coming off of heroin or methamphetamine or a street drug, number one, the advice is always, yes, you should sober up. No one would disagree. No one would be like, yeah, you should stay on heroin. You should figure out a way where you can like keep it in your life. Same with methamphetamine. But the perception of, let's say, methamphetamine and Adderall, the differences in the perception of those two drugs is extremely disproportionate to how different they really are.
Yeah.
And that's true for the general, very general category of uppers and downers, whether they are street drugs or real drugs. And I feel like I know so many people working in a jail who have plenty of experience with both, plenty of experience with street drugs and prescribed drugs. And it's so consistent that people tell me there's not much of a difference. There's a big difference depending on how you ingest it. But as far as the actual substance, there's not much of a difference in the effects of it and in the withdrawal from it. And many people have even told me that it's harder to withdraw from prescribed drugs.
Well, benzodiazepines in particular, many people say that it's harder to withdraw from benzos than it is to withdraw from heroin.
Mm. Yes, I've literally heard that. Yeah. So talk to me about...
Sorry, I had to say about the positive side of the desirable effects.
Right. Every drug has desirable effects. So yeah,
this is going to be brief. So desirable effects. Okay. So many people say antidepressants saved my life, but of course, you know, these are many people who are dependent on antidepressants and are really unaware of the difficulty that they might have if they ever want, as we were talking about, want to stop taking them. So I suppose the only positive that I can think of is sometimes they have an emotional numbing effect when people start taking them. So if somebody is going through a great deal of emotional distress, then this might help them. But this generally is short-lived. But the emotional numbing might be useful for some people for a short time. But there's nothing to say that that will actually happen, because as I said before, you know, the experiences are very unique to the individual. So the other thing that I would say is, I suppose that for many people, a doctor's or a psychiatrist's diagnosis and then subsequent prescribing of medication validates the way they feel, doesn't it? And it's easier to accept, as we talked about before, it's easier for them to accept, you know, their faulty brain chemistry is at fault and not their life. So it's easier for them to say, oh, it's not me, it's my OCD, my bipolar, my GAD, my whatever condition they've been diagnosed with. So I suppose from a prescribing point of view, that might be something that helps them initially. Mm-hmm. That's about it, I'm afraid.
Mm. Yeah, that's bleak, but accurate.
That's about it, I'm afraid. You know, some people say the placebo effect, you know, people can think that they might think, you know, oh, well, they take placebo and the placebo effect might be a good thing for some people. But it's really quite wrong to think of these drugs as inert, you know, medications. These, as we've said, these are psychoactive, psychotropic drugs, and they're powerful. And the placebo effect really, really, really isn't, is quite misleading to think that it could be justification for taking these drugs.
Oh, yeah, I agree. What has the world come to? It's just baffling that we've let this happen. And I always encourage people to, there's the four general key terms related to this whole topic, and those are diagnosis, which is, you know, exactly how is a condition conceived of in the first place, what's the criteria, how is it diagnosed, and then there's etiology, which is the question of what's causing this, and then there's prognosis, which is the belief about what would happen, what's the natural course of this condition, is it terminal or is it very short-lived, and then there's treatments, and your choice of how to treat something is going to be informed by your belief about the etiology of the condition and even the diagnosis of it in the first place, the solidity of the condition as a concept. And, you know, obviously we could have very long conversations about like each one of those points, but right now we're focusing on the treatment of antidepressants. But I raise this because we have to point out that there are many beliefs implicit in the choice to prescribe and or take antidepressants. And one of the beliefs, of course, is that it's correcting a chemical imbalance. And now, even if I could imagine that there could be people who know that that's not a real thing, that who have been educated about the mythical nature of the chemical imbalance theory, and maybe some people are fully aware that they're simply taking a drug, that it's just a psychoactive substance that seems to be helping them. So maybe there are those people. But I still think that most people have embraced the belief that there's a chemical imbalance in their brain that this antidepressant is correcting. And we need to just really clarify that's definitely not true. And this has been clarified in many ways. And we know when. You know, we know the origin of this idea that there's a chemical imbalance in your brain, and it was essentially a marketing type of ploy. So that's just, I just feel like we need to clarify that in every conversation we're having. Just let's uproot this belief out of the collective mind, because it's simply false. So, so we have to just be honest that what we're talking about right now is just taking drugs. And some drugs are helpful and some drugs are harmful, and mostly they cause dependencies. And the fact that we've justified prescribing antidepressants to children whose brains are so vulnerable, it's just unacceptable. It's unacceptable.
It is. Yeah. the chemical imbalance theory is, I say, it has been a commercial and political no-brainer for so many people, but the only people that have been harmed are the patients.
Yes. And, you know, it's funny, I also try to imagine, along with the friendly, brilliant psychiatrist that I try to imagine, I also try to imagine the type of person who would say antidepressants saved my life. And, you know, if I kind of like feel the presence of that population, and, you know, what would I say to them? Because obviously I want people to feel better. I don't want people to be depressed. And I'm not wholeheartedly against chemical support for feeling better and not depressed. But just because a person's not against chemical support doesn't mean that antidepressants are the best chemicals to support someone who's depressed. I think there are many other things. And I mean, yeah, there are many other natural substances, be they cannabis or even alcohol. And I don't advocate abusing alcohol. But when you look at it, it's kind of the same general effect.
Absolutely.
I know I'm talking more than I expected to or usually do, but I appreciate you listening. And can you talk about medication spellbinding? I think this is a very important concept. Can you explain what that is?
A medication spellbinding is often called anosognosia. A medication spellbinding is it's probably some of those people that say that antidepressants have saved their lives. The medication spellbinding is a state where people actually believe that the antidepressants are helping them. But in reality, what is happening is that they are behaving very differently and they have a lot of personality changes, and other people recognize that the antidepressants are actually doing them harm. And this happens quite a lot. I think it's Peter Breggin who talks an awful lot about it. Yeah. Don't know whether you've heard him talk about it, but
I have heard him talk about it too. And it's almost like a parallel to a person thinking they're good to drive after they've been drinking. And their friends are like, no, you're not good to drive. Your judgment is impaired.
Yes,
it's like that. Your own self-awareness can become impaired.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then you won't see clearly exactly how something is affecting your mental, emotional, and behavioral activity.
Yeah, so it's exactly that. And one of the things that if you listen to people talk, if they have managed to come off the antidepressants, and their realization of the person that they were when they were actually taking the drugs is frightening. And one of the biggest problems that we have is that the guilt that people feel for the way that they've behaved or the way that they've acted while they've taken these antidepressants is one of the most difficult things actually that people have to deal with. And it is incredibly sad. It's almost like, for many of them, years of their lives have been stolen. Because for many of them, their personalities have been changed and their lives have been damaged to the point where they've lost their homes, they've lost their families, they've lost their jobs, and it's not until they actually come back to being if they ever will be who they were before, but it's not until they actually withdraw from the drugs that they actually recognize what had happened to them. And this is so far from uncommon.
So what would you say to someone who's listening, who is currently taking antidepressants? And I know that I'm not asking you to give medical advice right now, and that's not what's happening, but just what would you say? Like, what do you say to people?
Well, first of all, I'm not a doctor, so I never give medical advice. But what I would say is inform yourself. Know the facts about these drugs. Find a doctor or a psychiatrist who understands these drugs if you can, because that's key. And if you feel that you're in a position where you might want to start reducing your medication, then that might be an option. What I would say is if somebody has been on antidepressants for a very short time, then they should only be on them for a very short time. Again, everybody is in a unique situation. Depends on the length of time somebody has been on. It depends on the dose they've been on. Depends on the type of antidepressant. Mm-hmm. Depends on how they individually react to the antidepressant. And this is one of the problems. Where do people get help? Where do people get help? Because when they start to look for it, there is no help available, especially in the States. Well, by the way, you do have lovely state-of-the-art clinics that are very happy to relieve people of tens of thousands of dollars to help them in 2 or 3 weeks.
Right.
Yeah. And I think you know what I would probably say to that one.
Mm.
The problem is that most of the people who have been on these drugs for a significant time are dependent. And whether they realize it or not, they will have become dependent on these drugs. And once you are dependent on these drugs, that's when it becomes incredibly difficult to withdraw without some adverse effects.
Hmm.
I'm not very cheerful tonight, am I? You know, I have a laugh a minute listening to this podcast.
Oh my goodness. Some things are serious, though. So we got to be serious about it.
Yeah.
Let me ask you this question. And the question is, why are there so many antidepressants? And maybe as you kind of think, collect your thoughts about that, I'll just read off a long list of antidepressants that are currently available. And as many people know, they have weird names. There's like this weird technical name and then another weird cover name, sort of. So we have Abilify, Paxil, Fluoxol, Bactiv, Haldol, Fanoft, Phenergan, Risperdal, Zoloft, Latuda, Pristiq, Baxdela, Clozaril, Celexa, Thorazine. There are etc. Zyprexa is another very common one. Then, of course, Lexapro and Prozac. These are extremely commonly prescribed. Why are there so many?
They don't make Prozac anymore.
They don't make Prozac anymore?
Well, they make fluoxetine, the generic, but they don't make...
They've lost their patent, essentially. So fluoxetine is the generic version of Prozac?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Good to know. Yeah. So, yeah, why are there so many?
Well, if we think about it, it's very similar to why are there so many brands of any other consumer goods. So I suppose when we, the first one, 1988, Prozac, that came along, and then I suppose another pharmaceutical company thought to themselves, wow, how much, $3 billion profit in the first however many years? So they thought, I want a bit of that. And I think it has slowly progressed so that they've seen the mass market that's there for these drugs. And they've taken the opportunity to introduce a new one. And each time they've introduced a new one, it's claimed to be better than the last one. And we've allowed this to happen. What's happening now is in terms of once a patent expires for a brand, then the generics take over, which are not making the same profits as obviously the brand drugs are doing. So there are fewer new drugs now being introduced. I think the latest one was in March 2019 when the FDA approved sketamine, which is based on ketamine, which was, it was licensed with a, given approval with a very low bar in terms of being, in terms of its trials and being regarded as a positive drug. So it seems that each time they're lowering the bar in terms of what they perceive to be acceptable.
Do you know off the top of your head how long the trials were that they did to approve this last one?
I do. I think I put it in my book. I don't want to quote because, but I know that there were, I think there were only two positive trials. And even one of them was quite questionable. And there were quite a few people who did actually question whether it should have got approval or not.
Mm.
And this is, you know, this is based on ketamine, a powerful drug. And it has to be administered in a clinic setting. People have to stay for a while after it's, this is like a new, different regime of of giving antidepressants. Whether it's the future or not, we will see.
So, again, just in case there's people who are kind of interested in like the business of it all, it's my understanding, but correct me if I'm wrong, that a pharmaceutical company can manufacture a brand new drug whose chemical structure has essentially never been existed before. And then they can patent that, and it will exert some specific effect on, again, neurological activity. And then in order for, and then the MME, you know, if it's approved, it'll have a patent. And I believe the patents last for 10 years. Is that your understanding, or is it longer?
It can vary, but around that, yeah.
Okay. And then once that lapses, then the patent is not re-upped, but rather generic. Other companies can essentially just make the same exact drug based on the same chemical structure and sell it. No, not quite right.
We think that these drugs are the same. We think the generics are the same as the brand drug, but it's actually not true at all.
Mm.
We're starting to realize, or we're starting to think. So once a brand name, once a brand name drug patent expires, any pharmaceutical company can apply to the FDA or the MHRA, and they apply with what's called an ANDA, so it's an abbreviated new drug application. Abbreviated being the important word here. Okay, so and they apply to. For with an ANDA to make a generic version of the drug. So, for example, June 2006, patent for Zoloft expired and generic sertraline could be made by anyone, any pharmaceutical. They just had to put in an abbreviated new drug application. And this new sertraline can cost 20 to 90% less than the brand drug. So the problem is that we are being told that they're the same, but they're actually only approved on similarity. So there are no clinical trials. They're not identical. The generic manufacturers do not see the brand drug registration file. So they don't see the original recipe for the drug. So they don't see what was. So the people who make sertraline don't see how Zoloft was made. They just have to make a similar drug. So they basically develop their own formulation for a drug. And this isn't just antidepressants. This is all generic drugs. So the problem is that most of these generic drugs are being made in countries like, I'm a great Asia lover, so I'm sorry for this, being made in China or India or... And the quality of the manufacturing is really questionable. Not only the quality of the manufacturing, but also the different levels of bioequivalence as well. So basically, we're getting similar drugs. We're not getting the exact same drug. This is really important with psychotropic medication because maintaining balance about taking the same level of drug, so taking the same dose of a drug. So if you're switching between generics and you might be getting anything between sort of 80% and 110% bioequivalence, it's quite easy to become unbalanced. And I have seen people go into involuntary withdrawal when they've been switched to a generic, and I have seen people suffer akathisia when they have been switched to a different generic.
Wow. Because either the dose will be lower or higher, less. Wow.
Yeah. So there are some brilliant books. There are two brilliant books that have just been written about our dependence on, well, actually your dependence on generics, because I think it's even greater in the States. It's really something that we need to understand more about. And in particular with drugs that are affecting the balance of our mind and our body.
Mm. Thank you for explaining that.
I just want to say that if somebody, because a lot of people don't even understand why or don't even think about why they're getting a different looking packet every time they get a new drug. And what they need to do is if they do have a new drug and they do have adverse reactions, they really need to make their prescriber aware of it.
Mm.
And avoid it if they can, but it's not so simple. It's really just not simple. It's a very complex problem.
Yes. The other thing that I think is relevant here is, I guess, the issue of prognosis, the assumptions made about the prognosis of the condition. And I think we are made to believe, you know, companies who make antidepressants want us to believe that the prognosis is very bad, that if you are depressed, that is your condition. And I mean, they go as far to explicitly say, at least if not imply, that it's permanent, that it is the permanent condition of your brain. Your brain produces a depressed state. And what a depressing prognosis. And so even to just question that assumption and consider the possibility that depression is definitely temporary, and that, who knows, maybe there is a certain constitutions of people who are more prone to it and will experience periods of it throughout their life, and other people are more prone to experiencing periods of heightened anxiety. So I think that's totally natural. And to that degree, I suppose you could say that a person is prone to being depressed. But first of all, there's the question of like whether that's, how temporary is it? Because obviously nothing's permanent. So how temporary is this? But then there's also the question of what is the real source of this depression? And I feel like there are people who would just hate to hear me say this, but is there any value in the emotions associated with depression? Is it a signal indicating that something is wrong, either in your individual life and bubble, or on a much grander scale of the condition of humanity? And again, I think many people would hate to hear me say this, but I definitely believe that human emotions are very carefully selected by evolution as very important signals for the state of things and how conducive they are to our individual and collective thriving. And so if you wipe out all depression, we might lose very important feedback that our brains are giving us essentially about, again, the state of things and how conducive they are to our thriving. So there's just a lot of assumptions that have to be questioned in this whole narrative.
Yeah, I agree. I agree totally. And it's like going back to the fact that if we start to think about the fact that most of the conditions we find ourselves in, we can realistically most of the time work out what's going on in our lives and what's causing them. And surely, as long as we continue to prescribe antidepressants and see them as the first option for treatment when we get in trouble with life, then how are we going to grow as human beings? How are we going to develop? How are we going to learn? How are we going to cope in the future? I mean, it's...
And how will we ever glean the insight that we could eventually pass on to future people who will be depressed?
Exactly. And, you know, there are lots of studies that have been done to show that. I think there was a study at Brown University, I think it was about 2006, that showed that 85% of people who have a depressive episode recover within 1 year without any treatment.
Mm. Speaking of prognosis, gosh, that and I hope that offers people tremendous hope. I think it should. It's such a gloomy outlook.
We've become so reliant, haven't we? We've become very used to, I mean, don't get me wrong, some people are in actual real difficulty. Life's not easy, is it?
No.
It's really not easy. But how do we uncondition ourselves to thinking that if there's something wrong with our lives and we're having difficulty coping with it, that we have to go to a drug?
Mm.
How do we do that?
It's a great question. How do we uncondition? I think this conversation hopefully is one little drop in the ocean of doing that. Because I do think we need to be communicating about all these underlying beliefs that we have been conditioned to embrace. And I think the point that you raised about being antidepressants being like the first line of defense essentially is crucial, because it's true that it is often used as the first thing, the first solution. And if you make antidepressants the 10th solution after trying 9 other things seriously, then, you know, that seems more logical to turn to chemical support. Now, yeah, I don't even know if that's true, but the other 9 things, I mean, all the basics of physical and mental, emotional health.
If we had a good prescriber, the first thing they should ask us to do is wait.
Beautiful.
Watchful waiting should be the first, because for most people, life is so fast moving. Our situations change. You know, very quickly, people's lives change. And to give powerful psychoactive drugs as first-line treatment, and very often, these physicians can see exactly what is going on in somebody's life. It makes me very angry, actually.
I share that feeling.
It makes me very angry. You know, and again, if prescribers gave us the full information so that we were able to give informed consent when we were given the drugs, if they told us about the adverse effects, if they told us about the long-term effects, if they told us we might become dependent on these drugs and have great difficulty of withdrawing from them, that we might become suicidal, how many people would think twice? I know I would.
I would too.
I know I would. But unfortunately, people aren't being given the opportunity to know everything that they should know about these drugs when they're first prescribed them. And they're not given the opportunity You know, we've been told we should all be, you know, proactive members of our healthcare team, that we should take responsibility for our healthcare. But at the end of the day, most people still think doctor knows best, so I'm just going to do whatever they tell me. I think some people are genuinely starting to ask, you know, should I take this drug? Are they effective? Is it the best thing for me? But we need more people with that mindset, and we need people to start questioning and taking some responsibility. I'm not ever blaming the patient. I don't ever do that. But I think it's important that we, yeah. I mean, we Google everything. We do 3 billion Google searches a day. But how many people Google what an antidepressant does?
Yeah, you're right. It's not hidden. The information isn't actually hidden. There probably is hidden information about results of the trials or something like that. But the adverse effects are plain to see. It's true. You're right. You know, it's not hard to access that basic information.
It has been. It's not as easy as it should be. But I'm hoping that I think it is becoming more accessible, and hopefully my book will help.
Yeah.
But I hope my people pick up my book before they take the antidepressant.
Me too. And
wishful thinking.
That's the thing, is if it was before, then it wouldn't end up being before anything, because they wouldn't end up taking the antidepressant most likely. But again, just a note, you know, to my imaginary person who is severely depressed and is desperate for anything that will help, I feel true compassion for anyone experiencing that. And I know that when you're desperate, you're going to try anything. And especially if an authority figure who's educated on the topic, at least seemingly, tells you this is going to help, it makes total sense that in your desperation, you'll reach for chemical support. I so get that. And there's no judgment that should ever be passed on anyone who has taken antidepressants. But the point is, I think here we are. This is the state of things. And we need to be talking about what we're talking about moving forward, because I think many people regret taking antidepressants, significantly regret taking antidepressants. And I know that they would want to tell people who are considering it their story. And thanks to those who are telling your story too. I know that there are people listening now who know firsthand how horrific antidepressants can be. And I appreciate those of you who tell that story. It's important.
I think it's fantastic when somebody is in a position where they feel that they can share their experience with others, because what is being learned at the moment is from anecdotal evidence and not from research. It's the actual patients who appear to be the experts when it comes to psychotropic medication. But I have to say that it's not for everyone. And I hear a lot of people say, you must share your story. It's not right for everyone. Not everyone must share their story. That depends on your individual circumstances and where you are in life and who's around you in life and how that might affect you there are lots of considerations. So yeah. Whilst it works for some people, I don't think it's sharing, actually publicly sharing an experience, is right for everybody.
Totally true. Yeah, I agree. Well, what is your vision for the future? Let me hear your best case scenario and worst case scenario regarding, you know, the status of antidepressants and maybe mental health in general.
Oh dear. You know, this is where I get my sad face on, but I want to be optimistic. I will try to be optimistic. So I suppose, prescribed drugs associated with dependence and associated with withdrawal are at the moment a significant public health issue. there are millions of people literally around the world who are dependent on these drugs and don't realize it. I call it a wicked problem because it's so complex and there are so many interdependencies. And we're only just starting to unravel this wicked problem. What I think is, I hope we start to ask questions, and I hope patients start to ask questions. And I think that's one of the most important things that can happen. At the moment, the pharmaceutical industry are planning their next onslaught, and they're planning on, I think Asia Pacific is their next target. So all these people, I have a friend who lives in Sri Lanka, naturally resilient. He laughs at me when I talk about antidepressants. He said, we've been through that. We've been through this. We know how to deal with it. We just get on with it. So all the people in the world with their wonderful religions and their naturally resilient ways of life are now the next target.
That's horrifying.
So we'll see how that goes. But I think it's time to start really questioning the medicalizing of our emotional distress. One of the things that's really important is, you know, when we talk about the alternatives, and we really need to look at what's available for people, and especially in the States, you know, there's a huge shortage of, I think, psychiatrists, of counselors, of mental health support for people. One of the big things that we need is updating prescribing guidelines. So we need these drugs to be taken for shorter times. We need doses to be smaller, but we also need significant monitoring, which is not happening at the moment, especially for young people. So we need that to happen. I think if we need to choose, I think I've said this before, if we choose to take antidepressants, we need to take them for the shortest time possible. And we need to educate people to do this, because at the moment that's not happening. I think we need to recognize that if we, and a lot of people talk about this, it kind of makes sense, but nobody really thinks about it. If we take an antidepressant, or we switch an antidepressant, or we up the dose and we suddenly have an adverse effect, I think we have to start assuming that it's pretty much the medication that's causing it and nothing else until proven otherwise. And so I think, yeah, we need to start recognizing that a lot of the things that we are suffering nowadays, if we think that there are millions and millions of people taking these drugs, are probably caused by these drugs. And that's a huge problem. It's a huge problem. I think 1 in 4 visits to a GP in the UK are now classed as medically unexplained symptoms or of no etiology. And that's because they're the adverse effects of drugs. So this is a huge, huge issue. I think we need more research, desperately need more research into the adverse effects, long-term effects. We need to give informed consent to take these drugs. So our prescribers need to start being a little bit more honest about the effects of these drugs. That actually means that they have to be better informed themselves. So that's a good thing. You know, a lot of people talk about the fact that we need to address the power imbalance rather than the chemical imbalance. And actually, it's very true. It's very true. Yeah, it's very true. So education about akathisia, desperately needed. And that's not just for medical professionals. That's for emergency services, for anyone who works in social care, and also for the public, obviously, as well. And I think we have to question the potentially harmful effects of generic drugs as well. But I think we're just starting. I think we're just starting to make people more aware. I never say that people shouldn't take these drugs. That's everyone's choice. Everyone has a right to take these drugs. But what I do say is that everyone should be informed about these drugs if they're going to take them and educate themselves to the best of their ability. Not everyone can know every single fact about the complexities of these drugs, but educating ourselves in the basics is a good start. I wanted to read something from my book when we finished. Is that okay?
Please.
It's just a really short piece, but I think it kind of sums up where I, how I think about where we are now. So there is a growing awareness of the need for that paradigm shift in mental health. But as Danis Pura states, what that shift looks like in practice is a matter for much debate. So while governments around the world debate, medics remain willfully blind, and charities secure their funding, the change has to start with us as individuals, as advocates, and as informed patients. The fact that we know a doctor's appointment is often the start of a lifelong journey as a psychiatric patient with a stigmatizing lifelong condition and dependence on psychiatric medication means the shift starts by us questioning the overuse of antidepressants and looking at alternative ways to support and care for each other. It starts by becoming more knowledgeable, reclaiming some control and power over our own healthcare, and by taking responsibility to educate ourselves to the best of our ability. It starts by understanding antidepressants are not the easy and quick fix their makers and doctors say they are.
It starts with us. That's empowering. That's such an important message.
Thank you. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you.
My pleasure.
I'm not the best of speakers, but I'm getting better. I'm learning.
I'm not the best of interviewers, but I'm getting better.
Yeah, it's a practice.
I'm so glad that we're connected. And, you know, I'll let listeners and watchers know that we had to be perseverant to make this happen. We had a couple of technical issues that prevented us from doing this a couple of tries earlier, but we did it and I appreciate it. And I'm so glad that your book is available now. Can people find it in just kind of common places online?
Yeah, Amazon and all the big bookstores, book. They're not even stores now, are they?
I know.
Book sites.
Right. Sites.
Sites. Yeah.
Well,
but, I hope it does start to make people question. And my next book is on benzodiazepines.
Oh, you're in process of writing another. Oh, didn't know that.
And it's got a very, very American title. It's called The United States of Anxiety.
The USA. Well, let's have you on again. When that's published, that'll be another great conversation.
Yeah, it was really good to meet you.
You too, Beverly. Thank you so much for your time.
And no, thank
I trust
you.
We'll stay connected.
And good luck with the baby.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, I'll speak to you soon.
Take care.
Bye.